present time, and we'll get a little bit out of order here. Do Senate Bill 838. I guess now we can reconvene as a as a full committee. So 828, Dennis.
Senate Bill 828 prohibits termination of local exchange residential service when termination would significantly endanger customer or person in household of customer who is at risk of domestic violence, unwanted sexual contact, disabled person abuse, elderly person abuse, or stalking. And there are -1 amendments.
Senator Walker, do you want to speak on the bench?
Yeah, I think I'll do that, Mr. Chair, because there are folks here who can speak to this bill better than I. I am a member of the Lane County Domestic Violence Council, and I'm on the Civil Justice Subcommittee, and this bill came out of the committee's work, and the purpose is to prevent termination of telephone service for individuals exposed to threat of abuse, violence, and or stalking. And there are really good folks here who can speak to that, and I'd just like to invite them up to do so.
Okay, Ms. Goldenberg, Lee, and O'Neill, please come up.
And Ms. O'Neill will be able to speak to you about the -1 amendment also that we just got back today.
Welcome, and please get your order here and start.
Elizabeth.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, Chair Senator Nelson, Senators. My name is Elizabeth Goldenberg, and I'm a bilingual case manager for Women's Space, a domestic violence agency in Lane County in Eugene, Oregon. And I want to state for the record that I'm for this bill. So the following is my testimony. In 2001, President Bush made a proclamation for National Domestic Violence Awareness Month, in which he stated that our homes should be places of safety and comfort and not places of torment and violence. For this reason, he expressed that as a nation, we must prioritize addressing the problem of domestic violence and work together at every governmental and social level to end it. Domestic violence, for those who are not really familiar with it, is a pattern of assaultive and coercive behaviors. Mostly, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, it's perpetrated by men towards women. It involves physical, sexual, and psychological attacks, as well as economic and legal coercion to attempt to maintain power, control, and domination over an intimate partner. In domestic violence, the use of isolation serves to keep the victim from receiving any support. Batterers will then use patterns of degradation, enforcing trivial demands, verbal abuse, occasional indulgences, threats of violence, inducing debility and exhaustion, monopolizing the victim's perception, and demonstrating omnipotence. All methods of coercion also used against prisoners of war and hostages. Thus, women become hostages themselves, victims of terrorism in their own homes. Domestic violence rarely happens just once. Instead, abuse usually escalates, becoming more and more frequent and severe with time. Domestic abuse is the leading cause of injury to women in the United States. More women are assaulted in their own homes than anywhere else. And almost one-third of women murdered each year in this country are reported to have been stalked first and then killed by their current or former partners. As a matter of fact, leaving is considered the most dangerous time for a victim and her children escaping domestic violence. Given the seriousness and lethal nature of this matter, police intervention is extremely necessary to stop immediate injuries and to make a clear statement of social disapproval to the perpetrator. Police reports and interventions are one of the best tools that can contribute to a woman's safety and can also reassure her that her abuser's violence is against the law. Thus, she can be assured that he will be held accountable and prosecuted, and that she doesn't have to endure his beatings in silence and isolation. Experts say that domestic violence is the most preventable crime in America, given which our first concern should be the immediate safety of women and children in any community. Violence in the family within any culture should not be facilitated, condoned, nor tolerated. For all the reasons I've mentioned above, and to help keep women and children safe from violence perpetrated against them, even after they've left, I ask you to please consider passing the phone bill. This phone bill would not only serve to keep survivors and their children safer, but it would also greatly contribute to breaking the isolation to which they've been subjected to for so long. With a phone, they would be able to reach out to the services greatly needed to put them on a path of healing. Basic phone service would also connect them with a support system and with professional helpers who could guide them in times of crisis. And it would give them access to greatly needed jobs. Thank you very much, Chair, Senator.
A dash one amendment.
Talk about that just a little bit. I'm not going to be next. I think Cerise.
Hi, my name is Cerise Lee, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about my own personal experiences being a survivor of domestic violence. Me and my three children have had to flee our family home, and due to past unpaid phone bills acquired by my husband and I jointly, I had a hard time getting a phone on my own, which was very frightening. I luckily have had support by family members, had to pay a large deposit, and also have had restricted phone service due to my past credit history. But since then, I have been in good ratings, good standings with the phone company, and making monthly payments like everyone else. I am fortunate to have phone access because I am still having to use it due to stalking. I've had to access police and different support groups to ensure my three children and my own safety. So I'm for this bill and would hope that you guys would consider making this change for people like myself. Thanks.
So, hello, Chair and committee members. My name is Cheryl O'Neill, and I'm giving you my home address. I guess that's 24307 High Pass Road. And I work as the coordinator of the Lane County Domestic Violence Council. So this is where some of this sort of originated. The Civil Justice Committee has been working on this issue for a while. It arose in Lane County when there was a survivor who had a restraining order, but she was unable to access phone service and ended up without a phone. She was raped and witnessed the suicide of her ex-partner. Actually, I was a person who worked with her and was trying to help get her phone service, which was she had called and I had called, both offering to make payments and go on some kind of payment plan. And what we had ended up, what at the end the supervisor ended up saying was, well, you know, that's against the law. So I was that stopped me. I didn't know anything about the law. But fortunately, I could talk to some of the lawyers at Legal Aid, and they were kind of assured me there probably was a way around that. You know, we could work, you know, to try to get her a payment plan so she could have a phone. But then, and I was excited about that, and I was going to meet her the next week, but that weekend, this incident happened. And, you know, that was the end of that. She left the state. I remember safety planning with her, you know, trying to figure out how is she going to be safe, you know, if something happens without any kind of access to the police or to anybody else, even to a friend. And we were talking about, you know, what about her neighbors? But what is true for a lot of survivors is that they're leaving their home. They're living in a new place. She didn't know any of her neighbors. She didn't know who to talk to or feel comfortable talking to, you know, just anybody about what was going on in her life. And, you know, there was just this really, you know, it was a very, you know, scary situation, and she was without that access. So that really kind of started my desire to see something happen so that we could have that access for people. And we kind of did this very informal survey of what was going on with the, you know, throughout the community. We found that maybe one or two people a month, you know, this is just, you know, I can't, you know, this was not a formal, you know, I didn't go out and do research, but just by asking other advocates, particularly people who do kind of the long-term advocacy that work with people when they're really getting out of the situation, staying out of the situation, you know, what would be the number of people who might be able to benefit from this? We ended up with maybe one or two people a month in our county that might benefit from a situation like this. And And, you know, other situations that had arisen where people had not had phone service. You know, they hadn't, one woman who, again, had a restraining order, you know, couldn't get the down payment, couldn't have a phone, and the person broke her nose. She had to run out with her two kids to the neighbors to get a, to get access to a phone. It seems sort of, you know, sort of like a simple thing that maybe should just be able to be there for people. And then the other situation that arose was where we did finally, through some negotiating and finding the right person in the phone company, get a payment plan for one client, and it really made a big difference. Fortunately, there was no further violence in that situation, but there were other other things that came up. She was able to get a good job, and the phone really helped her do that, and she was also, her daughter was able to access some counseling that she really needed at a time where it was really kind of a crisis. So the phone made a big difference, even beyond the 911 issue, because one of the things that also happened in our county and is probably happening in other places in the state is that we started a free cell phone. We finally found out how the cell phone thing worked, and we're finally able to figure, okay, we can do free cell phone things for people without having to pay service. We could, at least they would have a cell phone, it's a used phone, but they could access 911. And that has been really good. That's been a good, helpful, you know, people feel a lot more secure when they have been able to have that 911 phone, but it has some serious limitations. One, especially for rural people, I happen to live in the country, so I know this because I had a cell phone for a while, and, you know, I can't access the cell phone for 5 miles from my house. You know, if I'm at home and something happens and I was relying strictly on the cell phone to give me to give me access, it just wouldn't work. I'd have a 5 mile drive because I've had to try to use my cell phone, and that's how far I had to go before I could get a signal. So there's definite limits to the 911.
Could I interrupt, Mr. Sure. Chair? Ms. O'Neill, I just want to touch on this point because you're right here with it. We have a 911 telephone tax to provide for 911 services. And we were trying to upgrade for enhanced 911 services so that if you are being abused by someone somewhere where you don't know where you are, we can locate you through your cell phone.
Oh, that would be good.
That would be very good, but unfortunately this legislature took some of that money from that program, and that's been delayed. And that's a subject of another bill I have next door in about an hour. But I just wanted to make that point that even if you knew where you were, that'd be great. But if you don't know where you are, that's not going to be very helpful for you.
Right. You're not going to be able to find. You don't have that automatic access to your address,
right,
if you've called through the cell phone. Yeah. Well, so there are definite limits to the 911. And also with the free cell phones, you can't access any of these other services that have made such a difference in people's lives. You can't call a crisis line in the middle of the night if you need it, if you just need to talk to somebody. And that's often, you know, the time when you really need that. So anyway, we really believe that this legislation would make a tremendous difference for a pretty limited group of people, and without, I'm hoping, any kind of real hardship on the phone companies, where, you know, people can't get this unless they enter into a payment plan, and they can't stay with it unless they continue to make those payments. So you know, that's what we're just hoping, that it can work out. The thing that I get to explain to you about is the change, is the amendment. One of the things that came up as we were talking about this bill earlier was whether or not it would be safe. Were there issues of confidentiality around the affidavit? So the affidavit is one of the ways that was put in to allow people to kind of like prove that they were in a dangerous situation. So one way is to get a court order, either a restraining order or some other court order, and the other way is to get an affidavit from one of these three professional groups that were listed. And we couldn't get any kind of final decision about whether that was going to be a problem or not. And finally, then at the end of last week, I did get feedback that people were very concerned that by either of those three groups of people providing an affidavit of that kind, it could kind of eliminate that privileged communication. You know, your attorney-client privilege. There's also a privilege with mental health people, and there's not an explicit privilege with advocates, but there's some implicit privilege. So the fear is that it would cause more damage without people realizing that they were, in fact, just by getting this affidavit, you know, opening the door to all of their communication suddenly being public. You know, it just seemed like it just wasn't necessarily a safe thing. So we thought we would just take that out, basically. So there's not an affidavit way to get access. There's only through the court process. And it does further limit the number of people who will probably be able to access the phone, you know, being able to get the phone through the payment plan. But it's probably the more prudent thing to do at this point, since we don't know what else it might open up for them. So that's all. That's what that is. So it does, it even creates actually a little less, probably, that the phone company would be open to as far as.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions for the committee? Ms. Powell?
Thank you very much. Well, thank you. And thank you so much for letting us jump up. We just had a little crisis we didn't expect. So thanks very much.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, Jeff, Shelley, and Jason. Jason Barber here.
I can lead off. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonette. I'm representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities, including telecommunication utilities. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 828. We think that it's a good and or innovative approach to deal with a very specific population. We'd like to know just a couple of things briefly. One is that this bill is modeled almost word for word on the existing medical certification program that does exist today in statute, and all of the restrictions, all of the requirements for to set up a payment plan to deal with past bills that exist in the medical certification also exist in this judicial certification. Also like to note that, as Ms. O'Neill said, the Dash 1 amendments also, put further limitations than even the original bill, but not so limiting that it wouldn't be useful anymore. It still is a very good idea, very good concept. And with that, I guess I would just urge your yes vote, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson, committee members. I'm Shelley Jensen. I'm Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for Verizon, and I'm also here today to speak on behalf of Quest, since they were unable to attend. Neither company has a problem with this bill. We particularly like the fact that it does mirror the medical condition procedure because we already have processes in place to deal with those kinds of certificates, so it shouldn't be a problem to just implement this issue as well. One sort of policy issue that we did want to bring out that this is probably not the day to deal with it, but just to make the committee aware of, this bill only applies to telecommunications utilities, which are the incumbent telephone companies. It does not apply to competitive telephone providers, which, for example, in my neighborhood, I actually have a choice between what is now Comcast, was AT&T, local service, and Verizon. So if I had Verizon, this program would be in place. If I had Comcast, they could very well choose to implement this program, but they aren't required to. We had a discussion with Ledge Council about making some changes, but because this fits into the residential service protection plan, we felt that it would be too difficult to recreate the medical conditions and the domestic violence conditions for both telecommunications utilities and competitive providers. So we just wanted to point out that at some point the legislature and probably the PUC are going to have to go back and revisit some of these code sections that were set up way before there was competition and just make sure that some of these services are available to all the consumers and or make some of them optional, whatever, the sense of the legislature is. So just an opportunity to point out how competition is starting to change the way the companies and the PUC relate to consumers. Thank you.
The line services rules to prohibit the termination of local exchange residential services, is that the thing that causes the problem?
It's, where is it?
Or is it just making it part of the whole chapter 390?
On line 19, Mr.
Yeah, it's line 19, correct. where it talks about telecommunications public utility. And we talked about getting just that wording changed, but because of the way it fits in with the rest of the statute, you'd have to change a whole lot more than just that.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Ms. Jensen and Ms. Lang were in my office very early on, and when I gave them a copy of the bill draft and suggested that we change that, and I was quite willing to do that, and that's when they went to have that discussion with Legislative Council, and it's a much bigger issue than for this bill. So we felt that this bill was okay to move forward, but at some point, as Ms. Jensen suggested, that legislature needs to take a look at all of these issues.
Okay. Jason.
Chair Nelson, committee members, my name is Jason Barber. I'm the Assistant Director for the Crime Victims Assistance Section within the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 828. As the Assistant Director, I provide the day-to-day management of the Oregon Crime Victim Compensation Program, and we receive over 4,000 claims a year from victims of violent crime. And the program's intended to assist those innocent victims with out-of-pocket costs that they incur as a result of their victimization. I can attest that for the victim population mentioned in this bill, security and safety is a top priority in their lives following the aftermath of their victimization, and the ability to maintain local phone service in order to contact family members, friends, local law enforcement, medical or mental health providers in a time of need, in many instances, is a thread that allows these victims to carry on with their life. I can tell you that from our claims experiences, in many of these instances, the spouse, boyfriend, caretaker, or family member who subsequently ends up ultimately being the offender is usually the sole wage earner in the house or has control of the finances. And as the victim is trying to put their lives back together emotionally as well as financially, it would be imperative that they have the ability to keep the security of local phone service that this bill would provide. I'd also like to mention that within the last year, DOJ, with the Department of Corrections, has implemented a statewide automated victim notification system called the BIND system, and that's the brochure that we handed out. And this basically would work very well with this bill. It's a system where victims can call a toll-free number, and their offender would have to be in custody, but they can check on certain statuses as they are in custody, and if they choose to, they can register with this system, and on certain status changes, the system will automatically call their phone number and let them know if the offender has been released, if they've changed facilities, that type of thing. One note, I was curious whether or not an individual that just had local service would be able to make a call to a 1-800 number. So I called US West this morning and asked a technician there, somebody with this local service only, if they'd be able to call this BIND number. And he said it really depended on whether or not there was a toll block on that individual. So I would suggest some additional amendments that you may want to add that they have local service plus without a toll block. And he said it was doable not to have long distance, to have local without a toll block, so they could make 1-800 numbers. And that's all I have. Any questions?
So you're suggesting another amendment. I suppose we're supposed to bring this bill up.
Mr. Chair, I don't like doing that, but we are so up against a deadline now, and that's a very small amendment. It'd be my preference just to move it and get that going as it goes over to the House.
Yeah, I got a couple questions, Mr. Chair. Shelley, is there going to be a cost shift if this bill passes and to the other customers in the local area?
Chair Nelson, Senator Byer, I don't believe so. For the medical certification, I don't believe it's, there aren't a significant number of people that participate in the program. And also, under the legislation, it says if the customer does not work out a payment arrangement or doesn't pay the bill, we can still discontinue their service. So it would, I don't think ultimately it would cause a significant extra cost to the phone companies.
Okay, Mr. Chair, another question. On that note, what does reasonable payment agreement mean?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, I don't know, but this does model exactly with an existing program we have for providing similar situation for people who have medical conditions that are certified by a doctor that they need to have telephone access. So I would assume that whatever definition we have been using for those years over what a reasonable payment arrangement is would just translate over into this program as well.
And you don't know what that is, right?
Not off the top of my head, yeah. No.
Okay. How big a disadvantage will this be to you versus the competitive providers?
Chair Nelson, Senator Barr, I don't really have a good feel for that. I would not think, again, I don't think there would be a lot of folks participating in this program. I'd hope there's not a lot, basically, just because of what you need to do to qualify for the program, not because I don't want us to fulfill the program. I was just trying to bring that up as an issue, that there are some areas where residential customers as well as business customers have a choice between providers. And it may very well be that the competitive providers would see that as a competitive disadvantage if they didn't provide the medical and the domestic violence programs. So they may voluntarily provide it. I'm just saying that the mandate only applies to telecommunications utilities.
Other question, Mr. Chair? And this, I guess, would be for the Jason. Would a restraining order in a divorce case meet the minimum requirements to, as a, at risk of domestic violence set out by this bill?
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, I think a restraining order is one of the criteria that would allow a victim to fall under this act. Just for a divorce, probably not. I would not think so. Usually restraining orders, the meat of the order is telling the judge basically that there's a threat of harm and whatnot. Would be my guess on that.
Mr. Chair, clarification. I guess, okay, now I'm trying to figure out what you just said, because I asked if there's a restraining order in a divorce case, but yet if there's a restraining order, whether it's a divorce case or any other case, it's still a restraining order, and that would then qualify for this. Is that
what
I heard you say?
Looking at line 20, I think it would. Restraining order in a divorce case would qualify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Ms. Jensen, when Senator Beyer was asking you about if it would impact other providers that wouldn't be subject to the mandate, a domestic violence victim is going to be choosing their own phone service. So one would assume they'd choose phone service from a company that would accommodate them under this type of arrangement. Would that be true?
Yes.
Okay. So you would be impacted positively in some sense.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I need to ask Ms. Johnson, is she all right with the suggested amendment by Mr. Barber?
The one about the toll restriction?
Uh-huh.
I think there may be another consideration here. Some people have toll restriction because there are people in their household that run up large, mm-hmm. long-distance bills. So I don't know that you'd want to mandate that they couldn't have toll restriction if they had a separate reason for wanting to have that. So it's just another issue that you need to look at.
Okay. Given that, Mr. Chair, I don't want to wait for an amendment, and I think I'll let people chew on that as it moves.
Okay.
Around.
Sounds very good. No further people signed up to testify, so we'll close public hearing and open up a work session on Senate Bill 828.
And, Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 828.
Senator Walker's moved an amendment to Senate Bill 828. The -1, is there any discussion, objection? So ordered.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes?
I would move Senate Bill 828 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senate Bill 828 has been moved to the floor by Senator Walker as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably a good thing, but I have a problem with it because I believe the restraining orders, and especially in cases of divorce, are extremely easy to get. And I'm afraid that, you know, even though Ms. Jensen said she didn't think it's going to affect that many people, I would have to disagree because I'm afraid that with that definition in there, that a restraining order in a divorce case is going to open this thing up to a huge number of people. And as she said, there would not be a cost shift because of the payment plan. I do not have, no one could give me what a reasonable payment agreement was. I don't know what the definition of that is. I wish someone could provide that to me. Maybe that would give me a little less heartburn about it. But because of that, I'm going to be voting against it. I just think that you need to tighten up that restraining issue part of it. And if you took out divorce cases or something like that, I think it would be a lot more palatable. But I'm hearing more and more in my office every day about almost every divorce case there is, people get restraining orders going both ways. And so for that, it'll be a no unless somebody can ease those concerns when it comes to the floor.
For the questions? So the motion is to move the Senate Bill 828 to the floor as amended. The record show that Senator Meyer objects to that would be a no vote.
A no vote, yes.
And, Mr. Chair, I'll work to allay Senator Byers' concerns between now and the time it gets before.
You can look up with Senator Metzger, Senator Nelson, and Senator Walker would vote for the bill. So, having received a majority vote, Senate Bill 828 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for taking that out of order for the sake of my witnesses.
That's good, good. So we'll get back to open up a work session on Senate Bill 235. Mr. Dodson.
Senate Bill 235 establishes standards governing transactions of insurance by depository institutions and affiliates. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there are dashed amendments.
And the committee remembers this is the insurance and the banking industry where we're going to level the playing field as such.
Oh, yeah.
Allows employers to offer insurance to their own products and services. So, any discussion on the proposed amendment, dash twos, or any other testimony that the committee would like to hear on this issue?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think we got quite a bit of good testimony on this bill. It's come full circle. And I hate that phrase, level the playing field. It's so overused in this building. But that's sort of what this does. So I'm in favor of moving the dash two amendments.
Any further comment from the committee?
Did we already do the dash ones?
You did the dash ones?
No, they were disregarded. Not being considered.
Not being used. So we're just considering the dash twos. Senator Walker has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 235. Did you do that?
I did.
Any discussion or objection? So ordered. And Chair would move Senate Bill 235 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. And I'll clear that. Close work session. Open up work session on 341.
Senate Bill 341. Excludes employment listing services from definition of employment agency. Declares emergency effective July 1, 2003. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and dash two amendments.
All right. Does anybody have any questions on where we're at with this bill?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. As you all probably remember, last Monday this bill was in front of us, but the dash two amendments got delivered moments prior to the committee. I had a chance to talk with the proponents of the bill, and it seemed that the Bureau of Labor and Industry both agree. I haven't talked with them directly, but the proponents of the bill said that they liked what the amendments did, and they reflected what their thought of their agreement with the BOLI was. So I guess I would ask we move forward.
Okay. Any further discussion? Senator Myers moved and asked two amendments. Objections? So ordered.
Chair, I move the bill as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Byers moves Senate Bill 341 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. Senate Bill 341 as amended will be moved to the floor. Senator Byers, would you like to carry it? Very good. Open up a public hearing, post-public hearing on Senate Bill work session on 343. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 575.
That was 341. We haven't been 343 yet.
Oh, 341. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. 340. Close the work session on 341. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 343.
Senate Bill 343 emerges certification authority with enforcement authority for persons who install and inspect water system cross connections and test backflow prevention device assemblies. There are dash two amendments that have been worked out to the Department of Human Services and the proponents of this bill. No revenue impact and a fiscal statement was issued.
Okay. Committee have any need for further testimony on Senate Bill 343?
They're happy, Mr. Chair. I'm happy.
You're leveling the tape. Okay. The chair would move the dash two amendments. Any discussion on the dash two amendments?
Mr. Chair, is there a fee increase included in those amendments?
Well, there are some fees. Director may annually offend these what?
Fees are established.
Fees are established.
Water system.
It's on the third page of the dash two.
There they are.
Is that a change in the way that it seemed like there was always fee assessments before? This is just a different way of stating them?
That's my question.
That's right. Is there somebody in the audience that knows that right away, Ron? Answer that question, Ronnie. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Murray, I'm with the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters. And before I begin, I would like to compliment you gentlemen on your tie, because everyone knows those are the colors of the fighting Lewis and Clark College Pioneers. through the chair to Senator Byers, as I understand your question, yes, there is a fee established, and the fee will be charged to water purveyors. And I am not a water purveyor, but my understanding is right now small community, and I shouldn't use the term community, but small water systems will not be assessed a fee. And to give you an idea of the fee schedule, the city of Portland, the large-scale water purveyors will be charged $350 per year to operate this program. The licensing schedule for the individual backflow testers remains the same, so that does not change.
Mr. Chair, I guess that doesn't answer the question. Is there a fee now, and does this raise that fee?
Through the chair, Senator Byers, this would be a new fee for water purveyor for a service that is currently being provided by the health division. Water purveyors have to submit a report on an annual basis to ensure compliance with different standards and so forth and so on that they set for the delivery of water, and this would be encompassed with that report that they submit.
Yes.
Who's a water purveyor?
Oh, they deliver the water.
Thank you. They deliver the water. For example, through the chair of the center, but like Portland Water, Bureau, that's a water purveyor. That's like a big water purveyor. But there'd be like Tualatin Valley Water, and many special districts are also water purveyors. But then it can get down to be very, very small water purveyors. For example, you can be a rural mobile home park that would supply water. Well, that water has to be supplied under the auspices of the health division to ensure quality and so forth and so on. But the very small entities were excluded from any fee whatsoever.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The bill on page 3, the amendments on page 3 say $30 for a community that has 1 to 99 service connections.
And Well, the fee may not exceed $30 for a community, so your statement was that you wouldn't charge them, but actually the statute does give them authority.
Okay, my understanding is that they wouldn't, my understanding was that under $500 connections, I believe they wouldn't be charged, but that was my understanding of the bill.
That's not what the...
If we have a representative from the Health Division, they can help me.
Yeah. Who's from the Health Division? We need to clear this up and see where we're at with all this. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Charmaine Baldwin, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Health Division. And within this, currently, there were no fees being charged for what we call an annual summary report by Community Water Systems. There would be fees. A community water system would be anything from 15 on up. So anything under 15 would not be charged. So that first one probably would be 15 to 99. And then I think it was broken out in there up to some of the larger water suppliers.
It went from 100 to 99, 990 to $75 fee. From 1,000 to 990, 1,999 is 200. Then everything over 10,000 would be 350. Do you have any idea of how many, how will this affect, or how much money is potentially going to raise?
I believe there was a fiscal report that was put in, and what we had done was trying to figure out how much that it would cost to actually run this program and do this portion of it, and then figuring out what type of a fee we could, and taking into consideration how many systems we do have in Oregon. And unfortunately, a lot of them are small systems because of the way the state is structured.
The fiscal indicates there would be expenditures of $63,000. You have revenues of you're paying that off. Then Department of Consumer Business for other funds of $27,000. There's two different things in there. Expenditure and the revenues, but then you have other funds from the Department of Consumer Business and Service. You need to look at this thing?
Yes, I don't. Consumer Business and Services wouldn't really enter into that. Oh. Yeah, I think so. We wouldn't be having anything to do with them.
We have a copy of this one.
On page 2 of the...
Do we have that fiscal? I haven't seen it, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Yeah, I have it. It's in our packet, I believe.
I haven't seen it.
Mr. Chair, I believe the expenditures and the revenues are an offset of the previous fees they collected, and lack of revenue and lack of expenditure. And I think the other funds for the DCBS, the $27,200, would seem to me to represent the anticipated revenues that would be collected from the DCBS in implementing any program.
I think that was with the original and not with the Dash 2 amendments. With the original bill that went through. This has been changed and been amended two times now. So originally it was going to Department of Building Codes, and now it is not. We're keeping it within the Health Division, the whole program. The whole program will be within the Health Division. We will not be putting the section that we were going to be for certification over to DCBS.
And that would mean the $27,000 would come into Department of Human Services then?
Right. The fee for certification for these people, which is currently in statute and we're currently doing, is not going to change at all. We're not changing the fees. We're not changing the structure, the certification, or anything. It's kind of like two sections of one program applying to two different people.
Okay. Any questions? Concerns?
I think that fiscal probably doesn't reflect the Dash 2 amendments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any other discussions on this bill?
Well, I just said one. Are you happy then with the changes? Do you feel this with the Dash 2 that this works out well for the issues that you had?
Through the chair to Senator Metzger, yes, I do.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have a dash twos here. The chair would move the dash twos. Senate Bill 343.
I'm a no.
Any other objections to the amendments? Let the record reflect that Senator Beyer is a no on the dash two amendments, and that Senator Vesky, Senator Nelson, Senator Walker have voted yes for approval. And chair would move Senate Bill 343 to the floor as amended with a repass recommendation.
So no.
Discussions?
All for it. I mean, yes. And Mr. Chair, the reason I knew what purveyor was because you asked that question on March 24th and I wrote down the answer. It's not that I'm a certified smart person on this bill at all.
Okay. Let the record reflect that Senator Beyer is a no on the motion to move the Senate Bill 343 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. So, 3-1 vote, the motion passes.
Senator Metzger, please go ahead.
Sure. Happy to bill, too. Yeah, we got to keep her total down.
And it's his bill? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, very good. Senator Metzger is.
My bill is up in another.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 343, work session on 575. Mr. Dobson.
Senate Bill 575 changes definition of contractor to exclude business that supplies personnel for performance of work under direction and supervision of a licensed contractor. Dash one amendments. No revenue impact, has minimal fiscal impact, no statement it was issued.
Okay, any discussion on the dash one amendments? We need to the testimony on this.
I remember this testimony. We had former Representative Mike Lehman here to testify.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And Carpenters Union had a little bit of an issue, but I think that's resolved. They're nodding. Okay. Then I would move, Mr. Chair, the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 575.
Senator Walker is moving dash one amendments to Senate Bill 575. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered.
And Mr. Chair, I'd move the Senate Bill 575 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 575 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objection. So ordered. Senator Walker, you want to carry that for old times?
All right, and I'll be back.
Okay. Public hearing on Senate Bill 602. Mr. Dobson.
Senate Bill 602 eliminates statutory rules governing which insurance is primary when a person lends, rents, donates, use of, makes available for test drive, or otherwise provides motor vehicle to another person in the course of business. No revenue impact, has a minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued.
Okay, we're in subcommittee at the present time. So, Mr. Fuller, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Darrell Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, and I have before you some compelling testimony in favor of Senate Bill 602. Attached to it is an article that came out in an Auto Dealers Trade Association magazine just last Friday by happenstance that you may get a chance to look at that impacts the bill. Essentially, the concept behind the bill is that drivers get into accidents, cars don't get into accidents. And when a business provides a use of a vehicle to an individual and that individual gets into an accident, that the person providing the vehicle should not be responsible for injury, death, or damage that was caused in that accident unless the person providing the vehicle was somehow negligent in providing the vehicle, negligent in maintaining the vehicle prior to providing it to the person that was using it, and of course a manufacturer should not be shielded from liability if there are manufacturing defects in the vehicle. But beyond those three exceptions, it is our belief that it is the driver's responsibility in an accident and not the responsibility of the vehicle for getting into the accident. Kind of unfortunate that Senator Byers had to leave, because a real interesting part of the... kind of fun thinking about this as I prepared the testimony and tried to find other industries that would have similar circumstances, and a Christmas tree grower seemed to be one of the more appropriate. And the example that I use in my testimony is that if a Christmas tree grower were to provide a Christmas tree to somebody and that Christmas tree were to burn up in the house because it dried out and caused a fire, under a similar set of circumstances, the owner of the apartment or the owner of the home could sue the Christmas tree grower for providing a Christmas tree. It is essentially the same logic that allows somebody who leases a vehicle to...
We're just talking about the Christmas tree grower.
Would you like me to tell my story again, Senator Byer?
Sure. I better hear it.
Senate Bill 602, I likened it to the Christmas tree industry in that if you were to provide a Christmas tree to somebody, say they had an apartment, they bought one of your Christmas trees, the Christmas tree dries up and catches on fire, that the owner of the apartment could then sue you as the Christmas tree grower for having provided that tree, and you would be liable. That is essentially what the current law in Oregon is with regard to providing the use of a motor vehicle to a third party. If somebody leases a vehicle, rents, loans, or otherwise provides use of a vehicle, and that's in an accident, somehow we're considered liable in the law, and we would simply like to eliminate that statutory provision. Be glad to answer any questions. Not aware of any opposition.
Mr. Chair. I guess just for yours and Daryl's information, there have been Christmas tree growers who have been sued, not specifically because house burned down, but because of they were accused of using pesticides on the trees and not informing the end user of that. So.
That's good. Okay, no further testimony that I see from anybody. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 602, work session, Senate Bill 202, and the chair would move Senate Bill 202. We don't
602.
Have any, 602. We don't have any amendments. The chair would move Senate Bill 602 before we pass recommendation. Discussions, objections? Let the record show that Senator Walker has been excused to go to another meeting. So ordered.
Sure, I'll carry it.
Well, your bill, Mr. Chair. I thought you'd carry it.
Well, I just want to share the keep the blame. I didn't feel like it was open up public hearing on Senate Bill 603. Mr. Dutz.
Senate Bill 603 provides that inventory financing security interest in vehicle need not be satisfied by vehicle dealer within 15 days of transfer of vehicle. No revenue impact, no fiscal statement has been issued at this time.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller for the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. I'm going to request that you not hold a work session on this bill on the belief that there may be some technical amendments that are needed to the bill. I will know by Friday, and then next week should be able to have a quick work session if the bill has the support to pass out either with or without amendments, depending on the results of some certified smart people looking at the bill on my behalf. Just to summarize the written testimony that I've provided to you, a recent Assistant Attorney General's reading of a current law provided a brand new interpretation of the law. And the law, which is 822045 sub K, says that a motor vehicle dealer has to pay off any liens on a vehicle they take into their inventory within 15 days. The purpose for that is if you trade in your vehicle to a dealer and you have a loan on that vehicle that you're making payments on, the dealer ought to be required to satisfy that loan when they trade the vehicle into you rather than letting it you continue to get your loan payments. The law does not provide an exception for inventory financing agreements, which we call flooring agreements, which are common in our industry. When a new car dealer receives a new car from Ford or Chevy or whoever they receive it from, we do not pay for that vehicle until we sell it. We pay interest to the manufacturer on the value of the vehicle while it's on our lot until it is sold. And then once it's sold and we have the financing from the sale of the vehicle, then we pay off the manufacturer. Now, under the Attorney General's reading of the current statute, we would have to pay off the full value of all of our new car inventory within within 15 days of receiving that inventory. That would essentially bankrupt every new car dealer in the state of Oregon. Used car dealers also have inventory financing agreements with financial institutions that cover the cost of vehicles they have in their inventory until they are sold to a consumer. So what Senate Bill 603 does is simply carve out the exception for these customary business relationships that auto dealers have either with their manufacturer or with other financial institutions to provide them with credit assistance in providing their new and used car inventory. Again, I'm not aware of any opposition to this. There's, like I said, a technical question about whether the drafting the bill does everything we need it to do, and I've got a few attorneys that are looking at that and promised to get back to me by the end of the week. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any good questions? Paul?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. We were working with Mr. Fuller and his organization during the interim trying to resolve it without legislation. We agree that this legislation is needed and will solve that problem and allow dealers and manufacturers to continue the normal operations that they've done for years. We urge its passage.
Thank you. Questions?
No, yeah, Mr. Clark, I mean, you don't want to get paid in 15 days. I mean, you think Ford and Chrysler, just think that was just dandy, huh?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, we actually are paid, but we don't release security interests because our security interest isn't noted on a certificate of title. This was to require those security interests to be released. Our security interests float under a UCC1 financing statement. Every car comes in, automatically attaches. Every car goes out, automatically detaches. So it doesn't really even make sense to satisfy our security interest because it's automatically satisfied vis-a-vis the consumer when the car leaves with the consumer. We negotiate our own terms to get paid, and we're happy with those terms. So.
We want to make sure. We want you guys happy.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, we're looking for an amendment on that one, and so we'll just thank you very much. So first public hearing. We'll go into work session with that. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 609.
Senate Bill 609 specifies that a person who offers security or offers to purchase security in violation of securities laws or by means of untrue statement or omission may be liable for damages. Allows investors to recover for damages involving fraud for securities purchased in the open market. Sets a 3-year time limit on actions. No revenue impact. May have a fiscal impact. No statement issued.
Okay. Thank you. Well, gentlemen, welcome. Please. Sit up there. You don't really have to move those microphones around. I think they're pretty sound sensitive, so they'll catch just about anything that you say.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Shore. I work at the law firm Stoll, Byrne, Lochte, and Schlachter in Portland, Oregon. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 609. I've handed to your staff some written testimony that I'd like to give to the committee. I'd like to expand on that and sort of explain the bill with some oral testimony as well.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, speak from the heart.
Senate Bill 609 is an amendment to the Oregon securities laws. The primary beneficiary, as I'll explain in a minute, is really the Oregon Public Employee Retirement System and some state pension funds and state funds that will benefit under this change to the securities law. Currently, there is case law that interprets the Oregon securities law as it stands today that provides that a plaintiff who purchases a security can only sue the person who actually passed title to that security to the plaintiff. For instance, OPERS has lost significant money as a result of the Enron fraud. Much of that, those Enron securities were not purchased directly by OPERS from Enron, but were purchased in the public market, for instance, over the New York Stock Exchange. Under the existing case law, OPERS would not be able to bring a claim against Enron for accounting fraud because it did not, to the extent that it did not purchase those securities directly from Enron. This change and amendment to the Oregon securities laws would clarify that situation and ensure that OPERS has claims and other state pension funds and some private parties as well have claims to address accounting fraud of that sort. The reason that this bill primarily benefits OPERS is because of some existing federal securities law. There is a securities law called SLUSA, which is the Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act. That law provides that federal law preempts state law in most class action circumstances, preempts state securities law in most class action circumstances, except for a specific carve-out for state pension funds and other public funds that are allowed to proceed under their own state securities law. It also carves out situations in which there are less than 50 plaintiffs. So the primary beneficiary is to allow the state pension funds and state funds to pursue their state law claims in state court. There are two other amendments in the current draft. One would strike the language other than a federally covered security under ORS 59.115.1A. It is our belief that when this statutory section was amended some time ago, that this language was mistakenly added. The current law, if you are not able to sue under federally covered securities, would pretty much eliminate the ability to bring cases under any on the basis of any nationally traded securities, such as securities in the New York Stock Exchange and National Association of Securities Dealer, NASDAQ securities. Finally, the amendment would eliminate the word offers from 59.115. The word offers in 59.115.1A was eliminated in prior legislation a number of years ago, supposedly a superfluous language, but the case law interpreting that change has concluded that the elimination of the word offers from the state securities law actually made the Oregon securities law narrower than the federally securities law, and we don't believe that was an intentional change, and that the Oregon securities laws, in fact, were designed to mirror the existing federal securities laws. There are a couple of amendments to the current draft that you have that are designed to address security changes that the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities would like to see made. Those are technical amendments that have not been presented to you that would scale back some of the language in the current draft. And I think the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities is here to talk about that. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get those amendments to Legislative Council in time for this hearing, but we were working with the Division on that language. So we're continuing to work with interested parties. There, I think sitting next to me is a representative of the Attorney General's Office, Fred Boss, and I think I'll hand it over to him. Earlier, Kate Richardson, the Chief of Staff for Randall Edwards, the Treasury Department, was here. She had to step out to a meeting. I believe she wanted to speak generally in support of this bill. I think she indicated to Mr. Boss that he could make some comments on her behalf.
Before we get to that, Senator Brown is just coming to the door. Welcome. Please introduce.
Hi, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Southeast and Northeast Portland and the City of Milwaukee. Thank you very much for being here, for hearing this bill today. I think it's a very good bill, and I would give you more comments, but my staff person has them, and we did not connect. So I would just urge you to consider the amendments and pass the bill out as quickly as possible.
You have some written testimony or something?
We will get you my written testimony as quickly as possible.
We'll keep this open for you because Kate Richardson may be coming back if you wanted to come back.
I could go back. Thank you.
We will try and accommodate every wish.
Thank you. Thank you.
Every wish?
Fred, go right ahead.
Chairman Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I'm an Assistant Attorney General and Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm testifying on behalf or in support of Senate Bill 609. There are various state entities such as PERS and the Common School Fund and SAFE that purchase securities in the open market. Sometimes these funds suffer losses as a result of fraud. the Department of Justice supports the broadest ability to recover for these various state entities. The department takes no position on parties other than state entities and their ability to recover. In addition, one element that is not in the present draft that we are working on is that we are working with the various interested parties, including the treasurer, to allow a state entity to become a lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit in the appropriate circumstances. I did speak with the representatives of the Treasury, and they do support this bill, and did want to, us to convey that we are working together on amendments to this bill and on working on the lead plaintiff element of this bill. Thank you.
Okay, just a quick question. I have a statement, I guess, with Scott here in the report that both clarifies and extend. You know, you give the example of Enron and Oprah's. How would it affect a private investor? Does it expand that authority? A private investor could just sue anybody?
I think Scott can probably address that.
Sure. It does, to a limited extent, expand the right of a private investor to bring a claim in an Enron situation. However, for all practical purposes, that expansion is incredibly limited because of the SLUSA, or Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act I mentioned earlier, preempts state law with two exceptions, the state pension funds that we were talking about earlier, and in cases where there are less than 50 plaintiffs. And in most securities fraud cases for large traded securities like Enron, clearly there are almost always more than 50 plaintiffs across the nation suing. So there may be some limited instances where private parties have some benefit from this extension, but it's very narrow.
Questions? Ms. Powell?
Well, just if I could just kind of feed that back to you, then. So the understanding is, in terms of limited expansion, basically taking that another approach that individuals already have that right to do that now.
Correct.
I mean, it really changed that situation materially.
Thanks for that clarification. In that sense, this doesn't create an expansion of the law in general at all. This, in fact, only brings Oregon law in line with the federal securities law and allows consumers and investors the rights that they have under the federal securities law. So to that extent, this is not an expansion. This just brings us consistent with the federal securities law.
Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Boy, Lanter. Hello again.
Hello, Chair Nelson, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter. I'm the Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, a member of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The division is charged in part with enforcing securities law in Oregon and regulating the securities industry in Oregon. And I'm here to testify regarding Senate Bill 609, which would expand private rights of action for certain types of security investors. One aspect of our mission is to promote capital formation in Oregon and to ensure the protection of those who invest in Oregon financial markets. We provide for investor protection through enforcement of the Oregon securities law and through our investor information program. Our enforcement area provides investigation into investor complaints and takes administrative and civil actions to enforce the law, as well as making criminal referrals to state and federal prosecutors. Our investor information program informs thousands of Oregonians about securities fraud each year through speaking engagements, fairs, written brochures, and through our website. With the huge increase in the number of Oregonians who have invested in securities in recent years, we are challenged to adequately protect all Oregonians from unscrupulous promoters and fraudulent investment schemes. The role of private litigation has become increasingly important to ensure that our securities markets are fraud-free and that fraudulent sellers, promoters, and salespersons are held accountable. In general, we agree with the sponsors of this bill that investors should be able to bring suits to recover their losses, not only from the company that issued the stock or the person who had title to the investment, but also from those persons who facilitate and promote the stock sale and who make their living by sales commissions. We also believe that investors should have the right to bring so-called fraud on the market lawsuits when they buy stock on the open market in reliance on financial statements and similar information that turn out to have been fraudulent. You heard this in earlier testimony with reference to Enron. However, we're also sensitive to the need to keep Oregon securities laws reasonably in line with those of other states so as not to discourage investment and the formation of capital in Oregon. We understand the sponsors of the bill will be proposing amendments to delete Section 3 of the bill and create a new Section 3, resulting in a new statute, 59-140. We believe these changes are appropriate since the original language would take Oregon law well outside the mainstream. We've also worked with the sponsors of the bill to ensure that the bill language does not create any technical problems for our enforcement activities. We take no position on the bill itself, since we believe those more familiar with the details of private rights of action are in a better position to weigh in on the specific changes which the bill would make. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the bill. Stand ready to take any questions you might have.
Questions? Your concern then was with Section 3 of the bill. And so we have to be looking at the new language.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it very much. Roger Martin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Investment Company Institute, and I believe you have testimony in front of you. I will try to keep your time schedule by highlighting that the Investment Company Institute is the National Association of the American Investment Company Industry. Membership includes over 8,000 members, most of whom are in other states, but there are a half a dozen mutual funds in Oregon, and there are a number of other investment companies. The Institute opposes Senate Bill 609, which would delete the terms other than federally covered security from sections 59115 1A and 59.1271A of the Oregon Securities Act. The proponents of 609 have said that this language was mistakenly added to the statute by a prior amendment to the Oregon Security Division, and the Oregon Security Division acknowledged that the prior amendment was intended for certain regulatory matters and was not intended to limit remedies for investment under the Oregon securities laws. However, this is not the case. The Institute worked directly with this department in the 1990s to produce exactly the language that's in the law. Prior to 1996, all of the mutual funds were regulated by both the states and the federal government through the SEC. Because states were increasingly imposing their own investment restrictions and disclosure requirements on the ability of mutual funds to be sold nationwide, the Congress stepped in 1966 and passed the National Securities Markets Improvement Act, which preempted the authority of the states to regulate in any fashion the offer and sale of mutual funds. Congress recognized that mutual funds were a major source of the revenue that the states took in, and therefore, as I testified on a previous bill, instituted notice filing fees to keep the revenue stream intact for the various states. This accomplished two things. It let the states know which mutual funds were being sold in their state, and more importantly, it preserved that revenue stream. With the exception of Florida, which did away with all filing fees, all the states have since done that. I'm not going to go through it all, but the National American Securities Administrators Association, which I believe our security division belongs to, worked closely with the Congress and with the Investment Company Institute to put together these model law that was passed, and in 1997, I believe, the Oregon legislature passed that. Tamara Salmon of the investment company Institute worked very closely with Jim Harlan, the predecessor to the previous speaker here at the podium, in developing these very same statutes, and we oppose the idea now of changing them. Now, I understood from previous testimony that there are suggested amendments to that section. I haven't seen those. Nobody's made me privy of it. So as it stands now, right now, Mr. Chairman, we're opposed to the bill.
Questions? We got some work to do here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any discussion?
Senator Brown's back.
Senator Brown, you want it?
Mr. Chair, you have my written testimony. I don't think you need me to read it. You're very capable.
I think we're going to read it.
No, thank you.
Unless you really want me to.
Do you want to speak something from the heart? That would be fine.
No.
Very good. Okay, well, we've got some proposed amendments coming out. We need to take a look at those, and so we'll close the public hearing and close the public hearing. We'll open up public hearing on Senate Bill 825. And Mr. Dawson.
Senate Bill 825 authorizes governor to declare abnormal disruption of market by proclamation, prohibits merchants and wholesalers from charging unconscionably excessive prices for essential consumer goods and services during abnormal disruption of market, punishes violation as unlawful trade practice, declares emergency effective on passage, no revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact, no statements been issued.
Okay, we'll have it just to put it into a supply for just a few minutes here. Step outside.
Okay.
Senator Martin.
We never saw. And Cheryl Pellegrini, you can come forward. And I have been instructed to go ahead and give my little spiel from the dais here while the chair steps out. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 825 is a continuation of a bill that I put forward in the 2001 legislative session. There you go, Mr. Chair. And it came about because there have been earthquakes. There have been situations of disaster. And most recently, we've had September 11th. And I have something for committee staff to hand out. If I can get Romy to hand it out to you. there's an organization called Council of State Governments, and I belong to Council of State Governments West. And in their 2001 October issue, they had a whole article on how can states stop price gouging. And this issue came up because of September 11th. And I brought my bill long before September 11th was ever on the face of the United States. But that issue prompted a lot of things that happened in the market as a result of price gouging. And in fact, in September of 2001, I have a press release from Attorney General Hardy Myers urging citizens not to fall prey to unconscionable gasoline sales tactics in the wake of yesterday's terrorist attacks. Of course, this is dated September 12th. There were, as a result of September 11th, there were a number of gas dealers or purveyors, or what would you like to call them, who increased their gasoline prices tremendously. We also have instances here during the Biscuit Fire in Southern Oregon where motel owners increased their rates substantially because there were no other places to get a motel. This bill requires the governor to declare a state of emergency before we can ever implement any of the acts in the bill. There are other states that have done this since September 11th, and those states are, my notes are, New Jersey, Tennessee, Idaho, South Carolina, Indiana, Texas, and Florida. And four of those require the governor there to declare a state of emergency before they can put an end to excessive prices. This is really important legislation because in Oregon we have a number of earthquakes. In fact, just last week we had three in Portland on the same day. And so I'm going to ask that Mr. Ebersole and Ms. Pellegrini address this issue because Mr. Ebersole has actually been very involved in working this legislation with me the last two sessions. And so with that, I'll let him tell you all about that.
Gene, please, we'll back into a public hearing also.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Eugene Ebersole. I'm an assistant attorney general. I have been with the Oregon Department of Justice as of 1st of May, 14 years in consumer protection. This bill dates back even further with myself. It goes back to a time when Senator Byers' district was in a severe state of emergency in 1993 with the Scotts Mill earthquake in which the Malala High School basically had to be condemned and torn down. That was a time when I was working with the late Senator Roberts, and we drafted the first concept of this bill. It has changed somewhat since then. I'd like to correct one change in Senator Walker's bill as it's written now, is this bill does not react to a declared state of emergency. That section was in the House version. This bill would take effect if the governor declares an abnormal disruption of the marketplace. It was written primarily in response to earthquakes, but in light of the 9/11 disaster, it also has a great deal of bearing in that situation as well. I've supplied with a statement for the committee a number of documents, the first one of which is a report written by our own state geologists, which does preliminary estimates of future earthquake losses, and a very cursory screening of it is almost shocking to see. It's based upon an 8.5 Richter scale, which they consider to be what would be an average earthquake if it were to hit Oregon. The loss of life is not as phenomenally listed. The loss of the injury is, and the loss of property is phenomenal. What is most scary to me, and why this bill has been so closely close to my heart and been sponsored by and urged for passage each time by the Attorney General's office, is if you look at Portland, it has three faults running under the city itself. And if we were to get, the last time I looked at this seriously was when in Seattle they had a 6.5 Richter scale earthquake in 2001. Luckily for Seattle, their tectonic plates are somewhat stable, if you can use that term. They don't move a whole lot. So the city got shaken up a bit, but they didn't shake up enough to knock the city down. Unfortunately, the tectonic plates under the city of Portland are not quite that stable. Our magma and geographic stability is quite less. If there were a 6.5 under Portland, and based upon the types of landmarks, buildings, bridges, and other man-made structures, I think we might be looking at something that was more akin to the San Francisco earthquake a number of years back where everything fell down. It would be catastrophic, especially financially, in the loss of property. The experience that we have seen over the course of years in the Attorney General's office by looking across the country, and there was documentation in the 2001 bill that was put in last year for Senator Walker, showed things in Florida and across the country when hurricanes and earthquakes and other catastrophic events occur. It is extremely common for itinerant construction contractors and for other profiteers to drop in from the state from every direction. This bill should really be clearly considered that this is not a bill to fix prices. It is a bill to fix price gouging. I firmly believe, and I believe the Attorney General would agree, that we believe and trust in that most Oregon businesses would never act as profiteers should disasters like 9/11 strike our state. However, there are some legitimate businesses that did take advantage of that. Not a great many. In 9/11, there was the perceived disruption of the marketplace in which a number of gasoline retailers jack their prices up by 400% almost in some cases. So the bill would address that. There has to be an excess of a 20% increase in the price markup. What is important to note in these days when we want to discourage too much excessive litigation is that the only person who can take action on this bill is the Attorney General. It operates through the Unlawful Trade Practices Act and would require court action, but one of the things that is in the bill, it does not require a jury hearing. It would be decided if there was price gouging by a judge. And again, the safeguard, there are two safeguards. One is that the governor first must declare the abnormal disruption in the marketplace. And second, there is a safeguard that the legislature could override the governor's declaration if they felt it was inappropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice, the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section, Assistant Attorney General. Just a couple of comments following on Mr. Ebersole's. I would note that currently there are 21 states that have some sort of disaster price gouging statute in place. The ones mentioned by Senator Walker are states that have enacted legislation since September 11, 2001. There were 17 states that had such legislation in place prior to that event. I would note again that whether or not a price is unconscionably excessive, It's not going to be an issue that's litigated before a jury. It's a question of law. It will be decided before a judge. If the state of Oregon, through the Attorney General, were to file a lawsuit, the judge would be the arbiter of whether or not a price under a certain set of circumstances was unconscionable in a way that violated the terms of this bill. I would also note that an increase in an essential consumer good or service by 20% or more is not a per se violation. There are affirmative defenses built into this bill which account for the fact that if a merchant or retailer or wholesaler is required to pay an increased cost in order to obtain the goods, either for reasons that are related to the abnormal disruption or are totally unrelated, then that is an affirmative defense and will shield them from any liability under this bill. In other words, if a merchant or wholesaler is forced to pay more for events related or unrelated to an abnormal disruption of the market, they would not be liable if they turned around and then charged 20% or more for the essential consumer good or service.
What part of the bill is that?
Mr. Chair, that is in Section 4, and it is subsection 3, 3A and B. And the final comment that that we would offer is that we've heard as a criticism of this bill that we ought to simply allow the market to react and to correct. But we would submit to you that in times of acute events such as earthquakes, floods, or other events mentioned in the bill, it often happens so fast and the prices rise so close in time to the event that the market doesn't have time to make the appropriate corrections. And we feel that in the absence of the market acting to correct, government regulation is appropriate and necessary. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you, Senator Nelson. So under this, under 825, that in terms of potential action that might be taken against any retailer or provider of goods or services, it would only have the potential to rise to that level if first the governor takes this step. So it's not just any action of price raising in the market for any old reason. There has to be a the governor is going to have to declare that something has existed that is of acute state concern, that's abnormal, and that this would be relating to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that's correct. And there was another version of this bill that would allow the governor to make the declaration as a state of emergency or abnormal disruption of the market. I would note that Senate Bill 825 is narrowed to just circumstances that would give rise to an abnormal disruption of the market. So, yes, it would not be if prices just go up because they go up.
Right. Or somebody, if I can follow Mr. Chair, just, sure. Just to clarify so that someone wouldn't have a different feeling about this, because someone's having a big festival somewhere and, you know, therefore I can charge more for my hotel rooms or whatever. I mean, this is not related to that at all. It would have to be subject to these terms and it would have to be a determination made by the chief executive that the particular goods and services as a result have been impacted.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, yes, that is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Thank you. Just a couple of quick questions, I guess. First and foremost, it says that the question of law to be determined by a court, not a jury. Is there any issue there, the fact that some of these constitutional rights may be infringed by the fact that you're denying them a jury trial?
Chairman Nelson, Senator Beyer, that is actually the state of the law now on different things. For instance, in a summary judgment hearing before a court on a regular litigation, if there is no issue of fact and it is a matter of law, there's no issue of fact and it's a decision to be made by law, the judge has the word and the final say on issues of law. What the bill does is define the determination of whether there is excessive price gouging as a matter of law and not an issue of fact.
Well, I guess it, to me there's some levels of interpretation potentially on that by the fact that you have an affirmative defense in here, and so obviously, I mean, it seems to me like there could be some little bit of, you know, it's not cut and dried, it's not black and white. You know, is it 19.9% or is it 20.1%?
Well, that might be an issue for the jury, Chairman Nelson, Senator Beyer. What it does is it determines whether, where did I see that, which section?
Section
4.2. Whether a price is unconscionably excessive is a question of law. An affirmative defense, it could be a bifurcated trial should there be an affirmative defense raised. I could see that your point would be taken that a defendant would have a right then to say, fine, the court has determined that it's an unconscionably excessive price. Now, do I have an affirmative defense based upon all these other facts? He could make a reasonable argument that as to the affirmative defense, he has a right to a jury trial.
Okay, is that said in here someplace?
It doesn't say that, but I think what the bill does say, Senator, is that it's only as to that one issue that it's a question for the judge to determine whether it's an excessive price.
Okay.
That wouldn't be a difficult thing to add if you wanted that put into the section under the affirmative defense part.
Okay. On that part, what happens if a retailer or someone is accused and said that you price gouged or whatever the word is? He goes to court and says, and the judge and or in this case now a jury says, no, we disagree that, you know, he was acting under the course of the law. Can he or she get attorney's fees covered?
Under the Unlawful, Chair Nelson, Senator Breyer, under the Unlawful Trade Practice Act, that is now available.
Okay.
For somebody who wins, the defendant who wins an Unlawful Trade Practice Act is entitled to attorney's fees.
Okay.
Well, it's discretionary, isn't it?
It's discretionary with the court, of course. It's not mandatory, but it is discretionary with the court.
Okay.
As it is with every award of attorney's fees, it's always discretionary with the court.
One more, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
And I'm looking at the definition of public body. Under Section 5, Sub 18, public bodies are not included in this, so it's okay for public bodies to define to gouge people, but not private people? Is that what that means?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, I think under the public body, the state has to allow itself, under the tort laws, to allow itself to be sued, and this is one instance that we didn't see. That was already in the act, I believe. Isn't it under 18?
No, that's added.
It's on page 3, 18. Line 38. I remember that discussion before.
We've had that since the 1993 amendments, and I think it was just determined that we were not going to open up some decision by, say, the Public Utilities Commission to raise rates as being a viable claim of action.
But if that utility PUC's decision meets all of these qualifications, why shouldn't we allow that to be opened up?
Hypothetically, Mr. Chair, Senator, by hypothetically speaking, I would say that under all the other state laws and Administrative Procedures Act, that the due process rights for those bodies to act had already been adjudicated at whatever hearing that was determined for them to take action in the first place.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify on this bill? This particular time?
Is there anyone signed up opposed?
Wasn't anybody signed up? Although I understand the rest of some undercurrent.
Well, Mr. Chair, if there's undercurrent, I'd like to see it on top of the current. Someone has a problem.
Does anybody wish to testify on this bill?
So much fine.
It's not.
I'm just checking.
We'll close the public hearing. And just one matter to come before this, before the committee, is that, as you know, the 11th is the last day we're to hear testimony, and we have about 7 bills that potentially are top bills. And I'm wondering if the committee would be amenable to a Friday afternoon meeting from 1 to 3 to hear at least some of those bills and take some of the pressure off us down along the line. That would be possible.
We need to do that. I'll be happy to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair, the 11th is the last day to hear bills for their first hearing. But we have bills in process with amendments, and we have time to do that.
We can still do those.
Yeah. Okay, that's right, Mr. Chair. I have no problem with if you want to start with this Friday, that's fine.
Potentially, right now we'll have a Friday afternoon meeting, and we'll clear up some of these bills, and that, I think that will take some pressure off us when we get to the House bills, because we're under a pretty tight timeline even with the House bills. We've got only 2 weeks here under helming. We've got 12 bills, House bills, I think, that have come over to us already, and there's potentially more. The minimum wage bill I thought we were going to get has been assigned to another committee, so we don't have the minimum wage bill.
That'll save about 2 days.
So, there's potentially the farm labor issue coming over, and maybe some telecommunication bills also. So if there's other business, we will plan to have a meeting on Friday at 1, and Mr. Johnson will get some of those notices out. So we'll close public hearing. Thank you.